From WBUR in Boston, I'm Bill Littlefield, and this is NPR's sports show, Only a Game. This week, 24-year-old linebacker Chris Borland retired from the NFL after just one season, citing long-term health concerns. Ahead on Only a Game, second-year player Andre Williams weighs in on Borland's decision. And we'll hear from one of the 26 wives of NFL Hall of Famers petitioning the league for increased pensions and health care benefits. Also ahead, meet the Florida girl who left softball for baseball. Also coming up, things get heavy with strongwoman Brittany Diamond. March Madness of a different sort hits Syracuse head coach Jim Boeheim, and NCAA refs cope with life under the high-definition microscope.
If we make a mistake, we're going to see it three or four different ways in HDTV. Our officials are held to a much higher standard in 2015 than they were in 2008.
Stay tuned. The NCAA basketball tournament is underway, and if your brackets aren't already busted, you're a member of an exclusive club. Win and you go on, lose and you go home. That's the way these tournaments work for the teams, and it's also the way they work for the officials. As John W. Adams, National Men's Basketball Officiating Coordinator for the NCAA, explains.
Advancement in our tournament is merit-based. We have an on-site evaluator kind of doing an eye test on the officials during the game, and they make recommendations on advancement, as well as we have experienced what we would call tape graders. And then I'm in a control room watching all or part of every game, and I make my own notes.
Obviously, John W. Adams is looking for officials who get the calls right. Positioning is also critical, but how the refs handle the stars of the show also matters.
So those two things I look for. I look for interactions between the official and the coaches of both teams, and more importantly, maybe even the players. I think the players know if officials are right or wrong. You can judge that by looking at their body language and their expressions and so on.
John W. Adams surprised me a little with that contention. Perhaps I've seen too many players called for fouls respond with astonishment. Me? What? I didn't touch him. Throughout the tournament, the excitement of the players on the winning team is obvious. The excitement of the officials who've been judged worthy of another assignment is less apparent. But according to Curtis Shaw, who's worked seven Final Fours, it's just as real.
When I went to my first Final Four, it was, oh man, I'm in the Final Four. And then it was, oh shucks, I'm a standby. You know, and then I went back and, oh man, I'm in the Final Four, but oh shucks, I'm in the semifinals and not the finals. And so until the day that I was the crew chief in the national championship game, that's probably the only day any referee can ever be truly happy, because you can't do anything else. So we're the same competitive edge and the same amount of, wow, this is great, but I want a little bit more that I think the players and coaches have.
Curtis Shaw is now the coordinator of officials for five athletic conferences. He has also been involved in mentoring young officials who dream of working the games everybody's watching. His advice, don't ever worry about what the players, the coaches, or the fans have to say about your work.
I used to tell my crews, especially when I had a young kid going to the gym, say, don't go in here and think they're going to like you. Everybody in this gym has a vested interest in who wins or loses other than you. It's a thankless job. But if your bosses are happy and they're writing your name down, assigning you to another game next week, then you're doing what you're supposed to do.
And if one of those referees who's handled the games well enough to make it all the way to the Final Four misses an obvious foul or sees a violation nobody else can find, no matter how many times they rerun the video, check out YouTube, and follow the tweets of their kabillion fellow fans, how does the guy who's been grading that official A-plus since round one of the tournament feel? According to John W. Adams, that's just one of those things you hope doesn't happen, and you hope real hard.
Well, I'm a practicing Catholic, and I swear in this job I've worn out three sets of rosary beads. I mean, I'm constantly thumbing them.
As the tournament goes on, lovers of underdogs will be pulling for the long shots, and gamblers will be hoping they've correctly figured the spread. Beyond the members of their immediate families, few will be rooting for the refs. But as retired official Curtis Shaw recalls, that doesn't mean those refs don't get excited about what they're doing at the big dance. If he hadn't had butterflies in his stomach, he'd have figured something was wrong.
When you're standing there and they're doing the lineups and you're 4 minutes away from the biggest game of the year on the national stage, where if you mess up, everybody in the world will know it. Yeah, you've got to have those butterflies and those nerves. And so as long as they were always there every game, I felt like, okay, we'll handle it. So it was pretty good.
There's been a relative lack of orange in this year's opening rounds. In February, Syracuse University imposed a postseason ban on itself while the NCAA investigated the school for various infractions. And then on March 6th, the NCAA suspended men's head coach Jim Boeheim for 9 games, took away 12 future scholarships, and vacated 108 wins following the discovery of violations going back as far as 2001. They included extra benefits for athletes, academic misconduct, illegal booster activity, and failure to follow drug testing policy. At a press conference on Thursday, Coach Boeheim said he accepted responsibility for the conduct of everyone in the men's basketball program.
However, given the circumstance, I believe that the penalty imposed on the university as a whole, and me individually, are unduly harsh. For these reasons, I have chosen to appeal the Committee on Infractions decision.
I'm joined now by Sports Illustrated's Pete Thamel. Pete, what is the circumstance Coach Boeheim feels warrants an appeal?
He feels like, to use his word, the punishment was unduly harsh. He felt like the basketball program specifically was targeted. He even went out of his way to point out violations in the football program at Syracuse that weren't punished. The tenor of what he said was that the NCAA was kind of out to get him. And what the NCAA levied on Syracuse is harsh. It does handcuff the program for the next handful of years. And they did certainly go out of their way to single out Boeheim, and they used harsh language in the report. He, knowing no other way, is fighting back.
On Wednesday, you wrote, and I'm quoting now, "For years, Syracuse has exhibited the soullessness that is inherent with pursuing the spoils of big-time college sports. In doing so, it shrugged off NCAA investigations and persistent negative headlines as collateral damage." If that's the case, why has it taken so long for the NCAA to penalize the program?
They've been looking at this for about 8 years. NCAA investigations are interminably slow normally, and this one was particularly slow, Bill. To get caught doing as many things as Syracuse did, and certainly some of them were self-reported, but it's almost a holy trinity, Bill, of what they were caught for. So when you look at the severity of crimes and how detailed they were in catching them, it's a fairly significant case.
Boeheim also said this week that he plans to retire after 3 more seasons. Given the penalties handed down earlier this month, can he expect to have any more success with the Orange?
Yes. I mean, the beat will go on there. What it's going to do is it's going to really put an onus on the program to not make mistakes in recruiting. They'll only essentially have 10 scholarships available where most schools have 13, so it would inhibit them from taking transfers. It gives them very little wiggle room. But I don't think the results on the floor will be drastically different than we've seen for the past decade.
At Thursday's press conference, Coach Boeheim was unsentimental about his impending retirement.
No, I don't think there's any farewell. I'm not Derek Jeter. There will be no farewell tour.
But should there be a celebration, a parade throughout the campus when he does leave, given what he has accomplished?
Oh, there will be. He has helped Syracuse grow, just like Joe Paterno did at Penn State, from a regional university to a national university. I mean, there's certainly things to celebrate in Jim Boeheim's tenure.
Obviously, you've been following this story as an objective journalist. I have no doubt of that. But as a Syracuse grad yourself, what has been your personal reaction to this controversy?
I've never really had a personal tie to the athletic department at the university, Bill. I covered him when I was a student. My first job out of school was covering him, so I never really had that sort of attachment to the program. Or it's actually probably pretty much the opposite to the program. Because, you know, covering Syracuse basketball in certain times and eras, is you deserve hazard pay for it, considering the types of things that go on in the program. But I do think that the entity that came out of this looking worst was the university. I think they kind of overlooked what was pointed out, the NCAA pointed out, was done academically there to allow players to be playing.
You can find a link to Pete Thamel's SI column, "Jim Boeheim's Retirement Shows Syracuse Still Hasn't Learned," at onlyagame.org. Pete, thanks very much.
Hey, Bill, thank you.
Only a fraction of the players participating in NCAA Division I basketball will be good enough to make the NBA. Some of the rest will play in Italy. Some of them will play in Spain. And some of them will play in Iraq. Tamer El-Ghobashi recently wrote about that phenomenon for the Wall Street Journal. Tamer, welcome to Only a Game.
Hi, thanks for having me.
Your story focuses on Michael Kearse, and you say he brings a dose of swagger to pro basketball in Iraq. How does Kearse end up bringing swagger to a war zone?
Well, Michael Kearse has played in leagues all over the world, and before he arrived in Iraq 3 years ago, he had been playing in Lebanon. and he found himself without a new contract, and he was contacted by his agent. American basketball players had been trickling into the Iraqi Super League, as it's called, since about 2010. These teams are sponsored by ministries, whether it's the oil ministry, education ministry, the Ministry of the Interior, the police. These are ministries that are experiencing extraordinary cutbacks because of the fight against ISIS and the way instability in the country has reduced oil revenues. And yet, they continue. As one player, DeAndre Rice, said, he was astonished by the fact that basketball remains relevant, as he said, at a time when the nation is really undergoing an enormous crisis.
Kirst told you, "I thought it was going to be all bad with everything you see on TV about Iraq, but if he stayed for 3 years, it can't be all bad, right?"
Not at all. In fact, you know, I spoke to a number of players. They all uniformly said that their image of Iraq was of a war-torn nation that had none of the comforts of home. Now, granted, Iraq is going through its worst security crisis since American troops withdrew. But what they've experienced has been an Iraqi public that's very curious about them in a positive way. I've actually run into these players coming in at the airport, and you see a lot of the airport authorities, you know, after they stamp their passport, asking for a selfie with some of these American players.
The players do have some complaints, as I understand it, and it's not just the food and the lack of nightlife. How do they spend their free time?
Well, you know, they're pretty much confined to very modest hotels around Baghdad where they're looked after by the team staff. It gets very monotonous. So it's not necessarily the most comfortable life, but it's not at all the trying war zone that they had imagined in their mind.
The league in Iraq seems to be always trying to recruit new players from the U.S. Hey, you were there. If you had the skills, would you sign up?
Sure. I mean, look, if I had my choice, I would love to play in the NBA or even some of the more competitive leagues in Europe. But if I had few options and I was, you know, reaching the kind of twilight of my career, why not? And, you know, beyond that, it's just an extraordinary cultural exchange. Americans typically go there for some kind of diplomacy or maybe as military contractors, which Iraqis, I think, resent in a lot of ways because, you know, there is this element of making money off of their tragedy. Here, this is a group of Americans that are there to support a league that I think a lot of these Iraqi athletes really value, both for a livelihood and for the spirit of the game.
You can link to Tamer El-Gobashi's Wall Street Journal story titled Iraq Basketball is a Far Cry from March Madness, but it's not all bad at onlyagame.org. Tamer, thanks very much for speaking with me.
My pleasure.
Am I going to commit the prime of my life to something that could ultimately be detrimental to my health? That hurts, but I know this is right for me.
That's former San Francisco 49ers linebacker Chris Borland speaking to ESPN's Outside the Lines. Borland retired on Monday. He led his team in tackles last season and was due to make over $500,000 next year. His decision appeared to be abrupt, but he made it after speaking for months with concussion experts and former players. Adding to the NFL's woes, Borland's retirement came just days after a group of 26 wives of former NFL players sent an open letter to the NFL and its Players Association asking for increased benefits and health care. More on that in a moment. Will Borland's retirement trigger a cultural shift in the NFL? That depends on who you talk to. New York Giants running back Andre Williams was also a rookie this past season, and he has spoken this week about Borland's retirement and the safety of playing in the NFL. Andre, welcome to Only a Game.
Thank you, Bill. Thanks for having me on the show.
What did you think when you learned of Chris Borland's decision?
You know, I was just really surprised. The 49ers came and played us at MetLife. You know, it was a close game, and they ended up taking it in the last quarter. But Chris was one of the standout players, so I was just surprised.
I understand that his decision notwithstanding, you are not considering retirement after 1 year in the NFL.
Not at all, not at all. I'm good to go. I do not have any pressing health concerns at the moment. You know, I'm looking forward to this next season, and I'm actually down in Miami right now training at Pete Bomarito's spot with Rashad and a couple other guys.
The lack of health concerns notwithstanding, does the research linking football to brain injury and the NFL's acknowledgement that about 30% of players can expect to sustain damage to their brains concern you at this point?
It doesn't concern me. whether we're playing football or whether you're smashing your head into a wall or smashing into anything, there's some health risks that you're taking on, you know. But, you know, there are ways to mitigate those health risks, you know, taking care of your body. And you know, the helmet definitely does something. It works. I haven't had any concussions yet. And God's willing, I won't have any. But I don't necessarily think you can say, you know, if you play football, you're going to have brain damage, because a lot of people play the game and walk away from it healthy.
In explaining his decision to retire and forego up to hundreds of thousands of dollars that he was due to earn, Chris Borland told ESPN's Outside the Lines, "I just honestly want to do what's best for my health." Do you think that other NFL players have begun to think the same way?
That is a big question for me to answer on behalf of the rest of the NFL players. If Chris believes that that was what's best for his health, then by all means, it was time for him to stop. And I think that is the question everybody has to ask. No matter how much I'm looking to get paid this year, next year, if my health is at risk, I'm going to stop playing, because, you know, I don't think football is the beginning or ending to life. So there are a lot of other things that I want to accomplish.
It's interesting that you put it that way. Football isn't the beginning or the ending of your life, because in a way, that's counter to the culture of the NFL of the past, isn't it?
I suppose it's definitely, there was a point where, you know, I said, well, you know, maybe I can go to the NFL and, you know, if that happens, I'll make some good money and I'll be on a special platform that most people don't get to stand on. And, you know, that could be life-changing. But there are other routes to the things that people want out of life. And sometimes it doesn't take money or a platform to get those things. You know, really, some of the goals I have in life, learning to fly a plane, mm-hmm. you know, having kids and, you know, just having the time and the energy and the resources to be able to teach them things that I picked up along the way in life. So, you know, it's up for debate and it depends on the person.
It's interesting to me that you told Sports Illustrated's Monday Morning Quarterback, quote, "I don't play with hate in my heart or to injure people." I wonder if that's something that everybody else on both sides of the line is likely to be able to say.
I do think that there is definitely a difference between the players that play the game and the fans that watch the game. You know, I think football is a form of art. And I can't do anything but respect the people that are able to express their art form through this game. So, you know, it's just exciting to me. I don't feel any negative emotions toward my opponents after, you know, a win or a loss. You know, if you shake your hands and it's about winning the game, not necessarily dominating or hurting your opponents or anything like that. And I think the culture that surrounds the game, you know, can make the game safer. Not just, you know, rule changes or safer helmet.
I love what you're saying, and I think you've been very articulate saying it, but boy, it's a good thing you're not playing for Vince Lombardi.
Well, you can say it's a good thing, but you can say it's a bad thing, because he, you know, he was a great coach, so that I think that would have been a special thing.
Andre Williams is a running back for the New York Giants. Andre, thank you very much for speaking with me.
Thank you, Bill. Thank you for having me on the show. It was great.
Last week, the wives of 26 NFL Hall of Famers sent a letter to Commissioner Roger Goodell and NFL Players Association Director Demora Smith, stating that the league and the Players Association have neglected the needs of players whose careers ended in 1993 or earlier. Joining me is Jerry DeLaMalier. Her husband, Joe DeLaMalier, played for the Bills from 1973 until 1979, and then for the Browns from 1980 through 84. He was inducted into the Pro Football Hall of Fame in 2003. Jerry DeLaMalier, welcome to Only a Game.
Well, thank you so much.
I understand that you and your husband receive health care coverage now through your work as a nurse. What is the NFL's current obligation to Joe?
And a legacy fund monthly, and there are no health care benefits. The pension is $1,257.96, and the legacy fund is around $1,110 a month. I mean, we're by no means wealthy. We've raised six children. We had other kids live with us at one time. We have 11 grandchildren. You know, this next week we'll celebrate 43 years of marital bliss, and I do mean that, marital bliss, but it would be wonderful to have a pension where I wouldn't have to work and he wouldn't have to work except do things, you know, for charities and whatever when he wants to. I don't think that's a lot to ask for pre-93 players.
The letter sent by you and 25 other NFL wives presents a document called a pension disparity fact sheet. Tell me a little bit about the need among the players who retired before 1993 and how they differ from the needs of the players who retired after 1993.
The pre-1993 players have no cost of living increase in any pension plan. They have no health care benefits. I know there are players in the pre-93 group that either go without health care until they get on Medicare or, you know, and they don't see a doctor on a regular basis, which creates a lot of problems. You know, I think post-93, these guys have tremendous benefits, salaries. Nobody's asking for that. We're asking for a pension increase, which would give the pre-93 guys dignity to take care of themselves.
You and the 25 other NFL wives contend, and I'm quoting now, the pre-1993 players shouldn't have to appeal to the court of public opinion in order to be validated for what they did for the game of professional football. Have you and the other wives decided to go to the court of public opinion because other strategies just haven't worked?
Well, I mean, if you read through the letter, we're asking for a meeting. Nobody's asking for every player pre-93 to get $1 million a year or anything like that. We're asking for a dialogue because I don't think that it's understood what pre-93 players are going through. I mean, my husband knows professional baseball players who have been retired for years. He knows professional basketball players who have been retired for years, and he knows professional hockey players who have been retired for years, and they all say to him, boy, did you guys take it on the chin? You got nothing.
Have any of the parties to whom the letter was addressed responded to your request for a meeting?
Not at all. No. No response whatsoever.
Jerry DeLaMalier is the wife of NFL Hall of Famer Joe DeLaMalier and one of the women who signed last week's letter to Commissioner Roger Goodell and NFLPA Executive Director Demora Smith. Jerry DeLaMalier, thank you very much for speaking with me.
Well, I thank you for having me, and I really appreciate it.
If you're 6'9", 400 pounds, and you play a character called The Mountain on HBO's Game of Thrones, you're going to get some attention when you set a new world record for throwing a 56-pound kettlebell 19 feet 3 inches into the air with one arm. That's what Hafþór Björnsson did a couple of weeks ago at the Arnold Strongman Classic in Cleveland, Ohio. But what if you're 5'7" and your favorite color is pink? Only a game's Karen Given thought that was worthy of some attention as well.
You know, it started with rowing. I was like, all right, I'm just going to wear all pink all the time. It is my favorite color. And it just kind of stuck with me, and it's almost kind of like a joke now. You know what? Some people wear all black to intimidate people. I'll wear all pink. It works for me.
Brittany Diamond is a strong woman, and I don't know many men who are stronger. When we first met a few weeks ago, Brittany told me about her last deadlift set, 315 pounds. That's nearly double her body weight. She said it felt light and easy. Brittany might be strong, but she's definitely still girly. When we sat down to chat, I wondered how she found the time to style her long blonde hair into perfect soft waves. She apologized for her messy makeup, which was still more put together than mine on my best day. And then there was the pink. From head to toe, fingernails to socks, Brittany Diamond was wearing a lot of pink.
You know, a lot of the times when people think of strong man, they don't think of woman. Back in the day, you know, it was all men doing this, and it's just really cool because people look at you and they're like, you can do what? I'm not a bodybuilder. That is the complete opposite. You know, my sport has nothing to do with aesthetics, which is why I love it, which is another reason why I also think it's empowering. You know, a lot of men in particular are intimidated by that, and that's fine because my mom raised me to be strong, you know, do whatever the men can do. I have two brothers. People think, you're a little crazy, but I'm fine with that.
Brittany started training as a strong woman in July, as soon as she finished college and was no longer committed to her school's rowing team. She works in marketing and sales for a startup company, and her boss used to be a weightlifter, so he gets it. Brittany won the first real event she entered, which qualified her for nationals. She placed well at nationals, which qualified her for the Arnold Strongman Classic. When Brittany and I first met, she was about to hop a flight for Columbus, Ohio. We sent a reporter to follow her at the Arnold as she faced some of the strongest middleweight women in the world.
Attention athletes, if you have not registered at the head table with Sarah, she desperately needs you at the table to check in.
Walking into the competition was kind of mind-blowing. I've just never seen so many people that were that large. You know, the men were huge, and everyone was, like, so into different sports. You know, there was a mix of, like, bodybuilders, strongman, powerlifters, and they even had, like, world hula hoopers and jump ropes. So it was an array of all different types of athletes.
All right, judges ready. Athletes ready. Set. Go.
This weekend, the very first event is a Slater dumbbell clean and press, which is an oversized dumbbell. And I've done it at competition weight, which is 100 pounds. But I don't have access to the certain type of dumbbell it is. So just because I haven't, you know, ever tried that, I am a little bit nervous.
You've got a bunch of human pistons out there just pumping reps.
I'm just extremely happy because I've never touched that dumbbell in my life. I was hoping just to get one, and I got 5. Oh, my next event is my best one. Everything else coming up I've pretty much done before, so I'm excited.
They've got a full 60 seconds to complete this brutal 120-foot long course. They get one drop each way.
I'm a little upset because it was so slippery. I slipped. I had a great run down the way back with 10 feet left. I dropped it, so that adds a 2-second penalty to it. So I'm a little mad because that's my best event, but whatever, gonna move on. Third event is Farmers, 190 pounds each hand, 60 feet, fastest time wins. Okay, I think I did really good on that one. It felt awesome. My hands are split open now, but I felt really fast. So I'll see how I place in a few minutes. I lost my shoe during the event. I put a hole in my heel. I don't know how, but I did. But it's okay, because I'm not wearing shoes for the next event at all. Next up is deadlift, and I go barefoot. This will be a huge personal record for me. The most I've ever pulled is 345. So this will be a 30-pound PR if I get it, which, fingers crossed, I'm going to get it.
Come on, Brittany!
Can we make this quick?
Absolutely.
Okay, I'm just beyond happy because that was like a 30-pound PR. And I didn't think I was going to get it once, and I got it twice in the barbell. Twice in the axle, just missed my third one, ran out of time, so I'm beyond happy.
Like?
I'm gonna go cry. I'm just so happy. I can't even talk. I feel like I'm gonna die, so I'm gonna cut this short, but I'm so happy. I'm sorry. Oh my god, I just swore. I'm sorry.
3 days later, Brittany and I met up again. Her voice still hadn't recovered from the travel and the lack of sleep and, oh yeah, the emotions of competition.
I think I accidentally swore.
You did.
And I'm so sorry. So embarrassing. You know, that's not really, you know, like I said, you're just in a different level. Like, you can't really control your emotions when something like that happens. I was, like, crying and screaming, and obviously, normally, I wouldn't swear, but I was just, like, I was just flabbergasted.
We have machines that can bleed.
Okay, good.
It's fine.
Okay, good.
It's fine. So you told our reporter you had to go cry, and I thought, you know, I think it's really awesome that strong women can cry.
Oh, yeah, it's incredibly emotional for men and women. You know, when you put that much time and effort and dedication into something and you really give it your all, you know, certainly you're going to get emotional. If you didn't, then I don't think you're giving the sport your all.
Brittany's goal was to make it to the finals. The top four women qualified. Brittany came in 7th. Not bad, considering her first day of dedicated training was a little more than 8 months ago. Eventually, Brittany says she'd like to win the Arnold. But more than that, she'd like to stay in the sport long enough to see women compete in a pro class, just like the men do. The sport's growing rapidly, Brittany says, so she's praying that development comes in the next 5 years. For Only a Game, I'm Karen Given.
We had help on this story from Mike Foley at WCBE in Columbus. To see our video of Brittany Diamond at the Arnold, visit onlyagame.org. I'm Bill Littlefield. Coming up on Only a Game, art imitates life with respect to Cuban baseball players. But first, for our discussion of the week's news, I'm joined by Charlie Pierce, who's out there in basketball land, Pittsburgh, I think, this time around. Hi, Charlie.
Hey, Bill.
Nearly every year, the first day of March Madness is declared the best ever in terms of some metric and the worst ever in terms of some other metric. This year's day one beat out all the others in games decided by 1 point, and only 273 out of 11.5 million brackets remained perfect in ESPN's tourney challenge. So, best ever?
Yeah, a terrific first day. Well, not only 5 1-point games, but a lot of really well-played 1-point games. A lot of teams gave it a good run. Harvard took a real shot at North Carolina. Northeastern had the game in its hand on the first game of the day in Pittsburgh and couldn't get a shot off when they needed it. Iowa State got beat because they couldn't get a shot off at the end of the game. Yeah, there aren't very many metrics by which this was a bad day of basketball.
Not everybody is pleased with the madness of March. Jack Swarbrick, athletic director at Notre Dame, has identified what he calls a cultural divide in college athletics, basketball included, and it has led him to suggest that there should be, quote, more than one intercollegiate athletic association. As somebody who thinks one is too many of those, what do you think?
Well, I don't deny the necessity of having some sort of body to organize things. I'm not in favor of complete anarchy. But what has escaped the gentleman from Notre Dame, what's escaped his attention is there already are different levels of college sports. What he wants is different levels of the college sports in which everybody makes a lot of money, which is a different thing.
Well, in Mr. Swarbrick's model, the two different associations would, and I'm quoting again, reflect differing academic approaches. I'm wondering, does this mean that for the schools in one association, academics would sort of matter, and for the ones in the other one that was essentially semi-pro, there wouldn't even be a pretense of that?
I think that's probably what the way Mr. Swarbrick would sell it. I think pretty much what he wants is brownie points for the fact that Notre Dame has managed to maintain this, what I believe is a rather fictional illusion of being an academic power while running a big-time sports program.
Meanwhile, at their meetings next week, NFL owners are considering not one, not two, but 23 rules proposals. It sounds a little bit like a Monty Python sketch. More than half of those proposals involve expanding the rules regarding instant replay, so that ought to make the game a lot more fun to watch.
Well, huh? Especially if you happen to want to sell more luxury automobiles and
beer,
low-interest subprime mortgages. Yeah, I mean, a game that's already too long, a game that lasts 3 hours with about 11 minutes of actual action, is now going to extend itself.
Charlie, perhaps you have seen the YouTube series Between Two Ferns. This week we learned that the NFL turned down an interview request from host Zach Galifianakis, because they would not allow Commissioner Roger Goodell to, quote, subject himself to ridicule. There's a joke in there somewhere. I think I'll let you make it.
Well, first of all, Bill, we can excuse you getting Galifianakis wrong, but you shouldn't have stumbled over Zach, number one. And secondly, I maintain that they won't put Goodell on there because he's intellectually intimidated by the two ferns on the set.
Tom House, the ex-MLB pitcher who now works with quarterbacks, reported this week that Tim Tebow, quote, spins the ball better and is more accurate than he used to be. House says Tebow is ready to play in the NFL. Do you think any NFL teams will agree?
There's a huge, yawning, gaping, vast width of the Dardanelles difference between Tim Tebow throwing the ball better and Tim Tebow being ready to be a quarterback in the NFL.
Yeah, but he spins the ball better.
He does, perhaps on his head and perhaps on his nose, and we should throw him a fish. But he's still not ready to be an NFL quarterback.
Minor League Baseball's New Britain Rockcats have moved to Hartford. The team invited potential fans to vote on a new name, and the winner, according to some people at SI.com, is the very best name ever for such a team. How do you feel about the Hartford Yard Goats?
I don't even know what it means, but it's wonderful.
I need a shirt and a hat, I need them now.
It sounds very much like something you would say to insult someone in Arkansas.
You Yard Goats.
Y'all Yard Goat.
And finally, Charlie, last Sunday, an Ottawa Senators fan threw a hamburger onto the ice. after goaltender Andrew the Hamburglar Hammond helped his team notch another win. So, obviously, that's the last we've seen of that, right?
No. Curtis Lazar, one of Hammond's teammates, ate the hamburger. I, for one, can hardly wait until Montreal signs promising goaltender Louis Chateaubriand. Either that or the goalie for the Detroit Red Wings has to change his last name to Calamari.
You can find the sports writing of Charlie Pierce at Grantland, and of course he joins me each week here on Only a Game as well. Thank you, Charlie.
Thanks, Bill.
Young athletes often dream of growing up to be like their sports heroes. This week, during Major League Baseball spring training in Fort Myers, Florida, Only a Game's Doug Trabu met a teenage girl inspired by Boston Red Sox second baseman Dustin Pedroia to switch sports and compete with the boys.
This week, I've seen a lot of fans holding signs at JetBlue Park. That's the spring training home of the Boston Red Sox. Some made me laugh, others made me groan. But during batting practice on Tuesday morning, one sign near the Boston dugout made me turn around and walk back.
Can I have you give me your full name and where you live?
Yes, Sydney Dorr, and I live in Lakeland, Florida.
Sydney Dorr is 14 years old. She's about 5'3" with blonde hair, blue eyes, and a big smile that's lined with shiny braces. Her handwritten sign reads, "This girl plays JV high school baseball," because Dustin Pedroia said,
"Tell us what we can do. Tell us what we can be. One of us is going to be right. And go ahead. I've never heard it before. Tell me." Dustin Pedroia is my favorite player on the Red Sox. He is very awesome. You know, I follow him all the time and just follow his stats. And
have you had a chance to meet him?
No, I have not. I would love to, though. That would be my biggest dream in the whole entire world.
Dorr was born into a family of Red Sox fans. They moved from Barnstead, New Hampshire, to Florida in October 2004, just as Boston was winning its first World Series in 86 years. She became a softball player, but this year the eighth grader decided to follow her love of baseball, and the boys' team was the only option.
She tried out, and there was no way I could say, "You're not good enough to be on this team." There was just no possible way to do that.
Lauren Wheatcraft is the head coach of the junior varsity baseball team at McKeel Academy of Technology, a charter middle and high school in Lakeland. As a first-year player, Dorr comes off the bench. She's a catcher and an occasional second baseman.
First time she got up, she got an RBI. She helped us win one of our games by hitting a bases-loaded single, scoring a couple runs.
Wheatcraft says the school and the other players have been happy to have a girl on the team, but the teams they play aren't always as friendly.
We had an away game, and the third baseman of the opposing team hollers at me and says, "Hey, coach, I see you got a girl on the team. Does McKeel not have a softball team?" I said, "Yeah, we got a softball team." And he says, "Well, why doesn't she play softball?" And I said, "She's got a better arm to first than you do, so don't you worry about it." There was nothing said after that.
At the ballpark, while I was talking with Dorr, I noticed a woman taking our picture. Her mom.
Yes. Could I ask you a couple of questions?
Kelly Dorr made the more than two-hour drive to Fort Myers so Sydney could see Pedroia. She says her daughter's decision to play baseball came as a surprise, but she couldn't be prouder.
You know, we've pulled up to a couple high schools for a game, and people have said, "Oh, you know, the softball field is over across the street." We're like, "Okay, we're good." And they see her with the rest of the team, and they're like, "Wow." And it brings in people to watch because she's a girl. It's just, it's very funny.
Those quotes from Pedroia that Dorr wrote on her sign were part of a television ad he did a few years ago, but they are a real part of his story. The former American League MVP is listed at 5'9", has admitted to 5'8", and looks about 5'6". Coaches, scouts, and general managers wrote him off time and again because of his size, so he likes Dorr's story.
Oh, it's great. I mean, it's one of the reasons why we play and you want to act right is to, you know, someone's always watching and hopefully it impacts them the right way, and it's great to hear.
It's a different kind of challenge, but it's still a challenge.
Yeah, I mean, if she puts her mind to it, she can do it, and obviously she's doing that, and it's pretty cool.
Sydney got to meet her hero and get his autograph. Her next dream is to make the varsity baseball team and maybe even play in college. Regardless of what happens, she's sticking with her game.
Would you switch back to softball if, say, it was the difference between a college scholarship and...
I would never, just because there would be nothing that would bring me back to softball, because that's not my love, and baseball is my love, no matter if I play or not.
Dorr's playing days are far from over, and she's got a very well-known former underdog rooting for her in the big leagues. For Only a Game, I'm Doug Trabu in Fort Myers, Florida.
Yasiel Puig is a Cuban major leaguer who plays outfield for the Dodgers. He left Cuba with the assistance of smugglers, but Juan Rivera had nothing to do with that because Juan Rivera is a fictional smuggler in a new novel titled Cuba Straits, the 22nd book in Randy Wainwright's Doc Ford series. Randy Wainwright joins me now from WGCU in Fort Myers, Florida. Welcome to Only a Game.
Bill, it's great to be here, although I must say I'm missing some wonderful Grapefruit League games as we speak. So, by golly, let's hurry this up.
We'll do this quick and get you back to that 80-degree weather and me back to envy. Anyway, the apparent attempt to smuggle Figueroa Casanova into the U.S. to play baseball is only part of a multi-layered plot in Cuba Straits. But were you inspired by the intrigue surrounding the arrival of various non-fictional players from Cuba?
Well, I was, and I have been for many, many years. In 1980, a Cuban-American friend of mine wanted to go back and get his grandmother and his niece the Mariel Harbor boat lift. I was there for more than a week. I came back with 147 people on a 55-foot boat.
Wow.
Imagine a 55-foot boat, 147 people, all had been ill. And when they saw Key West, they took up this chant, Libertad, Liberty, Liberty. And it really stuck with me. So I myself have tried to help a couple of baseball players get out of Cuba. That dates some time back. But yeah, the current news played a small role in coming up with this book. Yeah.
I understand that sometimes you have been accompanied by one William Francis Lee, the left-hander later the Red Sox and the Expos. Tell us about the Randy White Bill Lee connection.
Bill Lee is one of my dearest friends. Got to know Bill during the short-lived senior professional baseball league. Met Bill on the field. I was catching for one of the teams, the Fort Myers Sun Sox, catching in the bullpen. We struck up a friendship and have been friends ever since.
What did you and Bill learn about baseball in Cuba when you were there?
We began taking teams to Cuba, so-called teams, sometimes legally, sometimes not. But we would also take tens of thousands of dollars worth of baseball equipment because, as Bill had seen when he was there and as I had seen in a previous trip, nobody loves the game of baseball like Cubans. We had witnessed children playing this game on fields they'd carved out by themselves using bats they had indeed carved from limbs of trees, using balls that they had made from asphalt and a bit of twine, and they would wrap it with palm leaves. So we began taking baseball teams there and also gear, and we would drive around the bus. And if we saw kids playing or adults anywhere in Cuba, we'd get out of the darn bus, have a ball game, and give away a bunch of gear and take off like the Lone Ranger. They never knew who we were. It was just awesome. It was such fun.
I don't want to give away the plot of Cuba Straits in this conversation. I don't want to neglect the novel, though, which also involves the love letters of Fidel and Raul Castro, an invisible boat, some terrific motorcycles, and an enormous Russian villain. Have I missed anything?
Golly, I can't actually wait to reread the book when you put it that way. But this book, Cuba Straits, I will say it was one of the most enjoyable writing experiences because it linked all these passions I have, one for Cuba, baseball. And I love researching Cuban baseball because I'm just a boneheaded baseball fan. Some years back, I found these archival videos of Fidel Castro playing baseball, and it is not a pretty sight, Bill. Although it's little known, and this fiction, and it is a fiction, that Fidel was scouted, almost drafted, by a scout named Don Hoke, it's just a wonderfully effective absurdity politically, but it's simply not true. So I drew upon that for the plot line of this book. You referenced the love letters written by Raul Castro and Fidel Castro when they were in prison. Those letters exist, Bill. I've seen them.
Wow.
I have photographs of them. And in the opening page of the novel Cuba Straits, there is a photocopy of one of those letters. Absolutely true. Absolutely true.
Let's jump from the fictional to the theoretically possible. How would you like to see a major league team in Havana someday?
I would love to see that, but I must preface that by saying I know a great many Cuban Americans who came to this country with absolutely nothing. Not only that, when the Castros came to power, their properties they owned in Cuba were simply taken. Their family members who disagreed with Castro's politics were executed, in some cases, shot off a high ledge that looks over Mariel Harbor. A brutal, brutal regime, a brutal takeover. And the animus Cuban Americans feel towards Fidel Castro is real beyond my understanding because I didn't experience it. So with that in mind, I would personally love to see a major league team in Cuba. We know so little about Cuba in this country, sadly, and we are easy marks, I will put it that way, in terms of information provided that have given us a very skewed vision of what Cuba is really like and what Cuba is really like, in my experience, for the people who live there. They live in fear. They are afraid every day.
Randy Wayne White is the extraordinarily prolific creator of the Doc Ford series of 22 novels and 10 more in the Hannah Smith and Randy Stryker series and 8 books of nonfiction. Randy, thanks very much for speaking with me.
Bill, it's been a delight. Good luck to you and your listening audience.